This evening I wanted to explore a theme which I think is very crucial at this time, and that is to make use some of this particular period of time and look at some of what is occurring on a kind of on a larger level. That this is a time in which there's a lot of uncertainty socially, a lot of really division, a lot of questions about the larger social structure. As we know, many of us are very concerned about that. And I thought that it would be appropriate to also make use of the fact that this is the time of the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I wanted to point to the kind of the vision, I think, that comes when we look very directly at the heart of our Dharma practice, the essence of our Dharma practice, and connect it with the heart of the approach of Dr. King and the approach of nonviolence that comes out of his work. I think it's very important to bring these together. In many ways, what we have with the teachings of the Dharma are a very powerful set of ways to work with greed, hatred, and delusion, to work with the what takes our minds and hearts and bodies out of being directed by wisdom and love. And we have beautiful practices that help us to work with that, particularly at the level of our own minds, and to lesser extent, I think, in terms of our interpersonal relationships. We have amazing practices for the transformation of individual greed, hatred, and delusion. And so one of the needs, I think, of our times are ways to bring this further into all the parts of our lives, into our interpersonal relationships, into our community relationships, and into our social relationships. There were, in many ways, certain limits historically that have been there for how the teachings developed. Primarily in monastic settings, there were not really opportunities so much to see what do these teachings mean for engagement in a larger society. And there was also in the societies in Asia where Buddhist teachings developed, there wasn't at all any sense of being a democratic citizen and engaging in a larger society. And it was primarily a monastic training. And in fact, one of the major guidelines for monks and nuns was to watch out for the political realm, which at that time was primarily that the realm of kings and queens, right? And so we have certain limited understandings of even that being an appropriate place to engage. And it's quite different in our world. We have, we might say, a more or less democratic society, but we have that notion of citizenship and of citizen engagement, and that is a part of our lives. So if we're interested in having practice inform all the parts of our lives, then we need, I think, some resources other than what we get directly from the tradition. We have guidelines, but we don't have resources. And I think that there is a very natural blending of many of the resources that we get, for example, from the life and work of Dr. King with the teachings that we get from the Buddha, the teachings and practices. And I think that this combination, and we need other resources too, but those resources, that combination, I think, is a very rich one. And it's particularly interesting because I believe that there's a shared heart to these two approaches. And that shared heart, if I had to say it very, very succinctly, is to be able to bring wisdom and love to every moment of our experience in every part of our experience, every part of our lives. In other words, it's a pointing towards a kind of wholeness or seamlessness or integrity of our lives. And so, but the question is, how do we do this in all the parts of our lives? We get a sense of how we can practice at the level of individual experience and consciousness. I think we get that from Buddhist meditation. We get some guidelines for speech and interaction and relationships. I teach a lot on using the resources of Buddhist teachings for speech, interaction. I think one of the challenges of our time is that really to have lives of wholeness and integrity, I think we need to make use of other resources than simply what we find in Buddhist teachings and practices. That's certainly my finding. And that's when we look to the movement and evolution of Buddhist practice, or probably any great spiritual tradition, into another culture, there's always a meeting of the core resources of the tradition with the core resources of the culture. And if I had to summarize very succinctly the resources of our culture, the best ones, you know, I would use words, I would probably point to science, democracy, and particularly psychology, and point to those three areas. And that's where a lot of the real integration is occurring. And in terms particularly of the social dimension, Dr. King's approach gives very powerful resources, particularly because you could really summarize his approach in a way that I think is very, very parallel to what we find with the Buddhist teachings. That is, there's the desire, the strong intention to bring wisdom and love to every moment. And it was his particular innovation to try to find ways to bring those qualities to social conflicts and the larger society. This is from Dr. King's work. Love must be at the forefront of our movement if it is to be a successful movement. When we speak of love, we speak of understanding and goodwill towards all human beings. We speak of a creative, a redemptive sort of love. And you find that repeated over and over again. So it's this sense that can we have our deeper nature, our deepest nature, manifest in all the parts of our lives, including the difficult ones, including the social dimension. Again, I think that is particularly a challenge right now, isn't it? You know, the challenges of our social world are large, and they promise to get larger. And also, I think that there's something about this combination of the Buddha's teachings and practices with the resources that we get from Dr. King, and I think a few other resources as well in the social realm. But that is particularly valuable now because I think what's needed to respond on a social level needs both resources. And my own sense is that there's gradually developing a different model of social engagement than has been predominant. You know, that has been there for most activists. I think that the model of activism, which has had, you know, has sometimes carried the concerns about injustice, you know, when no one else was doing so, that model, which tends to be oppositional, self-righteous, demonizing of the opponent, and not really having too much of a positive vision of where it's going, primarily oppositional. I think in our time, that is reaching its limits. And it's very likely that sort of model would and will be ineffective and even lead to a fair amount of repression in the next period of time. So there's a very important need for different models that are more like the ones we find with Dr. King that connect our practice. And I think also there's a sort of a vision, which is talked about sometimes in terms of sacred activist or spiritual activist, that I think is coming to the fore more, where anyone who's active in the world needs to have a lot of meditative practices to stay balanced, to stay non-reactive, to be able to respond, to avoid burnout. And so I'm interested myself in contributing to that model getting stronger and being more visible and more available. And I think it's happening in a number of different ways. You know, I think if you look to what happened at Standing Rock, this kind of model was surfacing in many ways. Some of you, if you looked at that and studied that, you know that it was led by Native Americans, and it was led by their elders. And the elders gave directions to have every action supported by ceremony and by prayer. And to not, they said, go on the warpath, which could be to maybe to follow that oppositional model. Here's a story that I heard from Charles Eisenstein. Anyone know his work? Very amazing writer. Look at his website, Charles Eisenstein. He's really clarifying a lot of these perspectives. His son was at the was there at the actions at Standing Rock, and this is what Charles Eisenstein said. I heard about one incident in which a group of water protectors went to talk to the sheriff about the water cannons. They were met with police who began to arrest them. One woman, while she was being arrested, began to sing a native prayer song, and soon all of the group were singing in unison. The police began to look uncomfortable. One of them even started crying. Another, who looked to be of native heritage, started to take his police helmet off, but then thought better of it when he saw that others were not doing so. And there were a lot of actions like this which were very much supported by prayer, by ceremony, in that native approach. And my view is that if they had followed the old model, the old oppositional model, there would have almost immediately been repression and probably violence. And that the whole success so far of this movement, I think, is largely there because it's followed a different model. And I think that's something really to hold in our own understanding. And I also experienced this yesterday in Oakland. Anyone at the Oakland March? Yeah. Wasn't it something?
Yeah.
Wasn't it something? And you know, probably, and some of you probably were at something in San Rafael or in other places. Yeah, probably very similar. You know, I went there yesterday. I live in Berkeley. I went to BART. Couldn't get on BART. There were lines that I've never seen before at BART. There were lines stretching two blocks just to get onto BART to go. I happened to run into a colleague of mine, Will Kabat-Zinn, with his son, and we went to the march by Uber. You know, which was the way to go. anyway, and there must have been, I don't know, someone says 60,000, I said maybe 100,000, just everywhere. There were so many people. You know, just as I saw, you know, like just people going to BART, the whole streets were filled with people, and it was celebratory. It was a different model. I actually didn't see any of the people with the black uniforms, you know, the so-called black bloc, who often engage in vandalism and who do not follow the approach that I'm suggesting tonight. But it was celebratory. It was a different model. It was in some way, I think, envisaging a new world by the very ways people acted. For a long time, I hung out with the Brass Liberation Marching Band. Did anyone see them yesterday? And just hung out with them and, just walked through the streets with the band, and people were dancing. It was kind of reminding me of what you see sometimes. Anyone see Black Orpheus, the film from the Brazilian Mardi Gras? Everyone's dancing in the street, That's what was happening with being around this band. And it was a different, very different feeling, and very, I think, another example of what's being pointed to, that I think very hopeful. And then, I saw New York Times had photos from similar marches all around the world. I think there were 500, right? And they were, there were photos from all over the U.S., Canada, Paris, Nairobi, everywhere. Right?
Antarctica.
Right? Amazing. So very, very, very positive. So I thought it could be helpful to hear a little bit from Dr. King, just to get a sense. And then what I'll do in the rest of the talk is I'll talk about what I think is further about what I'm calling the shared heart of these approaches, which is, again, very simple, I think. It's basically to bring our practice in a very direct way to every moment and every part of our lives. It's a life of full integrity, where we don't say, well, I have integrity in my personal interactions, but God, the world, I don't know. It's where you have integrity and fullness in every part of one's life. That's the vision. It's not easy, right? It's challenging. I think that's what's being pointed to now. So let me see if our technology works well. Let's see. I brought this from home. Let's see. Okay. This is Dr. King reading from a letter from Birmingham jail. It wasn't a speech. He wrote it as a letter. And so this is him reading it later. 1963, Birmingham, Alabama.
My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I am sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than in any other city in the nation. These are the hard, brutal facts of the case. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? When you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, You see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. And you certainly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park and see her developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and color, when your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stands, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degrading and degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. You assert that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never ceasing devotion to God's will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? I have no despair about the future. I have no fear about the outcome of our struggle in Birmingham, even if our motives are at present misunderstood. We will reach the goal of freedom in Birmingham and all over the nation, because the goal of America is freedom. We will win our freedom, because the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands.
So, quite a statement. You can hear how there's a very conscious sense with Dr. King of all of the actions coming out of the intention that he found with the teachings of Jesus, the teachings about love and bringing love to every situation. In a little while, I'll come back to that, but it's, I think, very, very parallel, and I'm talking about that as really sharing an approach, a basic approach, with our Buddhist practice that we really can see as this intention to bring wisdom, kindness, love to every situation, which doesn't mean at all simply being a pushover or being nice, that one can be very strong, very firm, but how can one do that continuous with wisdom, kindness, and love? It's a very challenging question. It's a challenging question for us when one's partner doesn't wash the dishes, let alone large-scale social issues, right? How do you work with a difficult coworker? Or what do you do with a neighbor who maybe is doing certain things that you don't like? So the aspiration, I'll say a little bit about what the aspiration is from both Buddhist and Kingian perspectives, and then point to how, particularly how King, inspired by Gandhi, thought that one can actually bring this approach to larger social issues, again, which you do not find with the teachings of the Buddha. You find sometimes that the Buddha intervened socially, And he talked occasionally about how poverty and there wasn't a concept of injustice, but how poverty and inequality led to social problems. He certainly talks about greed, hatred, and delusion. So there's this need to understand these core teachings in a wider way. And I think we get that in part with Dr. King. But to go back to the core of our Buddhist approach, we can see it in our mindfulness practice, we can see it in our loving kindness practice very, very clearly. It's the attempt to be present, to be aware, to be wise, to be kind in every moment of experience. And the way our practice works is we have that aspiration, and then we study over and over again where we're not wise, where we're not kind, where our conditioning comes up. You know, our practice, when we try to be mindful, what happens is we see all the ways that we're not mindful. We study it, you know. Again, I don't know if it's on the website of the Marin Sangha or on the website for Spirit Rock, but a large part of our practice is studying where we lose it, studying where we get stuck, studying in great detail, you know, our reactivity, our patterns, you know. And so we find in the, you know, in the teachings on metta, the teachings of loving kindness, there's the aspiration to bring this quality of the kind heart to every situation, every person. You know, those of us who've done metta practice know. And metta actually means sort of a deep friendliness. That's the root of the word. And with metta practice, we try to bring that kind heart to every situation and every person. Not easy, right? It's a very audacious, ambitious, and difficult intention, isn't it? Do you realize that you had taken that on? Every situation. It's not just where things are going well or people are nice to you. It's where people are not nice to you and where things are not going well. We have the same aspiration, you know? So it's not easy, you know? You know, we try to have the kind heart, you know? A lot of two of my own cutting edges these days with bringing the kind heart to all situations are with telemarketers and with drivers who tailgate me. Those are my own two personal edges. So I have, you know, with the, anyone do loving kindness practice with telemarketers? Recommended. Because I may use my phone differently than you, but I actually answer my telephone. Probably you just see the, you know, I don't have caller ID, so I just answer it and try to be friendly to telemarketers, because I once lived next door to a telemarketer, and I know what their lives are like. You know, I mean, or just say it's a hard piece of kind of work, right? There are people too, so, but it's very tempting to not to be kind to telemarketers, and there's not much on telemarketers in the classical teachings. So you have to, have to improvise. And so, but it really, the intention really is to have that sense of kindness towards all beings in all situations, right? It doesn't say just where people are acting properly, right? Just where people are acting, where they are acting in a loving way. It says in all situations. And, you know, if you've trained in loving kindness practice, you know that we have, you know, a sequence where you move from developing loving kindness where it flows most easily to where it doesn't flow as easily towards the so-called difficult person, right, in our practice, which when we do a week-long retreat, we don't bring in practice with a difficult person until the fifth day, because it takes a training, a build-up. But that's the motivation. The other edge personally for me is I have a vow of generosity when I'm driving, which helps a lot, right? And lately I've noticed I haven't been doing so well. I've been forgetting my core intention. But just what happens is if I just, someone, you know, particularly I don't like tailgating, people who tailgate me at 60 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, objectively it's not safe, but it's, so that's a harder one. But I try to bring generosity into my driving, but it's how do you, you know, this is part of our practice. We have to find ways to bring in that sense of kindness. That's the motivation. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, it says in the text, who knows the path of peace. With a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. It doesn't say some living beings. It says all living beings, right? And so, same thing with our interactions with people. From the 8th century, Shantideva, whenever catching sight of others, look upon them with an open, loving heart. And then the same thing with our mindfulness practice and our wisdom practice. We want to be with every moment of experience and as much as possible not be driven by reactivity. Now, reactivity is the way that I like to translate dukkha or suffering. You know, it's to, can I be not driven by my reactions, typically my grasping or my pushing away? Can I see those enough so that I'm not driven by them? And so that's what our practice is. It's about, you know, a way that I like to talk about this very, very simply. And I think this is an ordinary language expression of the Four Noble Truths. As I say, that the core of our practice is to be responsive rather than reactive. Responsive means that I'm not bound by my reactions. I'm not under the control of my impulses, my reactions, my old conditioning. That's incredibly ambitious intention, right? Can I be, to be responsive means that I'm not being controlled by my conditioning and my reactions. And I think the aspiration is to be responsive every moment. That's, you know, we would say full responsiveness is the same as awakening. Responsiveness with wisdom and love is awakening. That's what we aspire towards. And the aspiration is to have it be there every moment. So that's a very powerful intention. I think it's very parallel to the aspiration that King interprets as essentially coming from love every moment. And there's less of an emphasis on wisdom, but there's a lot of wisdom that helps us to bring love. You know, it's to see, so you look at King, he talked a lot about interdependence, you know, what we would call in Buddhist language interdependence. He talks about the way that all of us are connected. Let me see if I have this quotation. Where is this? I'm cognizant, he said, this was also from the letter from Birmingham Jail, I'm cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. That's the wisdom statement, right? That's about interdependence. Again, very radical. You know, we all have tendencies, if we have any degrees of privilege, to somehow not care about suffering elsewhere. I think we all know that, right? And there's something that I think that we have to question about that. We have to look at that and ask, is there a way that I can respond? And again, it's not to, we may respond selectively. It's not that we're being asked to respond to everything all the time, right? One has to make one's choices, you know, about where one responds. You find that in the life of King as well. He wasn't responding to all issues all the time, you know. And in fact, as you know, later in his life, he actually brought in issues that he was quite aware of earlier, like questions of class, poverty, and foreign policy. At the end of his life, he shifted and brought those more to the fore in the context of Vietnam. So he wasn't taking on everything, he was focusing, right? And I think that's important. But there are ways in which that sense of interdependence is very crucial, you know, to see clearly, to bring that wisdom. And so King, the language is a little bit more focused on love. He says, I've decided to stick to love. I know that love is ultimately the only answer to the problems of humanity. Hate is too great a burden to bear. I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And he talks about love as being what in all traditions is seen as the key to the ultimate nature of things, to the ultimate reality. Again, very similar to what you find in many, many traditions. I think you find in the Buddhist tradition, the deepest sense of our being is understood as connected with loving energy, kind energy, with metta. There's a sense that our deep nature, which gets covered over, is shining. Maybe some of you know passages where it says, at our depths we are luminous. And actually in the text, that luminosity is connected with metta, with loving kindness. And so to hear a similar message, that one has to act, one has to, again, the king uses different language, but we have to have that sense of responding out of love and wisdom every moment. Now what's interesting is that, and I think I'll just go into this area a little bit, and then we can open things up. What's interesting is that King at first thought that the teachings about love that he got from the Christian tradition were only really applicable to interpersonal relationships and one's own heart. You know, in a way that, again, we may take the Buddhist teachings and say, okay, these can really apply to my own consciousness and I think to my relationships. How do you apply them to larger issues, to communities, to the larger world? Not so clear, not clear developed teachings. And King had the same view, interestingly. And then when he was still, I think, in his early 20s, he read Gandhi. And it was a revelation. He said that Gandhi was the first person in history to bring these deep spiritual teachings and apply them to the social realm. And some of you know the history of the traditions of India, know that Gandhi essentially took principles of ahimsa, which translates as nonviolence, and karma yoga. Karma means action. And he brought these together and applied them to the British colonialism and the fight for independence. And that prior to that time, it was always something that was always on the scale of one's own mind and maybe one's relationships. You know, and there's the notion of ahimsa meant what one did in one's immediate relationships. Non-harming. Same word that we use for the core of our ethics in Buddhist tradition, ahimsa. And then there was this notion of karma yoga, which you get from the Bhagavad Gita and from that tradition, which we probably know best as it's been come into our culture as selfless service. It's action that itself is a spiritual path, the path of selfless service that develops one's heart and mind. Again, usually in interpersonal relationships. So some people very motivated by that in their work. You know, in their work maybe with others to, you know, whatever, helping professions or raising a family or whatever, that one can be motivated by that. And Gandhi came along and he took those ideas and he brought it into the struggle for independence. And so King comes across Gandhi, I think in his early 20s, and he says this, prior to reading Gandhi, I had concluded that the ethics of Jesus were only effective in individual relationships. So very similar to kind of where we are working with the Buddhist practice, right? How does this make sense on a larger scale? The turn the other cheek philosophy and the love your enemies philosophy were only valid, I felt, when individuals were in conflict with other individuals. When racial groups and nations were in conflict, a more realistic approach seemed necessary. But after reading Gandhi, I saw how utterly mistaken I was. Gandhi was probably the first person in history to lift the love ethic of Jesus above mere interaction between individuals to a powerful and effective social force on a large scale. So King follows with that, and he understands nonviolent action as a way of having continuity with the love ethic. And what I like is that it also is very much an expression, I think, for me, of what one of the most fundamental ways to express the Four Noble Truths in Buddhist practice. the teachings of the two arrows, which I probably teach every third time I'm here, right? which is one of my favorite teachings. How many have not heard me teach the two arrows? Okay, not too many. But are you open to being reminded of it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Because this is actually my colleague Heather Sundberg, with whom I teach. She's heard me teach it quite a few times. And she says now that when I teach it, it's a transmission. those are her words. I kind of like that, because it's something that I kind of struggled with for a lot of years, how to make sense of that teaching in relation to practice. Because in the text, dukkha, or suffering, is used in all sorts of ways. And it's used in different ways. So here's this teaching, okay? The Buddha was talking to practitioners, and he asked them, everyone experiences the unpleasant. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner? That's his question. As happens so often, no one answered, so he answers his own question. That was his teaching style, often. And so he said, all of us are at times experiencing the unpleasant. We can call that pain. We can call that difficulty, distress. We have difficult physical experiences in the body. We have difficult mental, emotional experiences. We're treated unfairly at times, and so forth. And the Buddha said that was like being shot by an arrow, the first arrow. And all of us are at times shot by that arrow. He said, practitioners and non-practitioners are both shot by an arrow in that way. What differentiates the two is what happens after the arrow is shot. He said, a non-practitioner, which always means us when we're not practicing, skillfully, a non-practitioner will tend to shoot a second arrow at oneself or others as if that would help because of the presence of the first arrow. So I have physical difficulty, I tense my body, I don't like it. Difficult mental, emotional states, I might blame myself, judge myself, blame someone else. Someone says something, I have a difficult emotion, I blame the other person, I react, I tell a negative story about myself, about others, I judge myself, etc. Difficult interaction happens, someone says something mean, I react right away back with something mean. That's shooting the second arrow. Now, what's interesting is that I think of the essence of nonviolence. It's about not shooting the second arrow. We have received pain as a social group. We will respond strongly, but we will not shoot the second arrow. That's the essence of King's nonviolence. Do you see how it's the exact same teaching as you find with the Buddha? Again, simple in that way. I think that's very important. Because it's really about how can we unify our lives. So what we want to find are ways to express that not shooting of the second arrow, one way of talking about it, kindness, friendliness, love, another way of talking about it. We want to find how to manifest that in all the parts of our lives, including the larger social dimension. So that's what King offers, and Gandhi, and other people. And I think we still have a long way to go with that. But that's really, I want to maybe end here by saying that's what I want to leave you with. Can we have a connection of the core of our practice with whatever we do in all the parts of our lives? And where is that harder? And how do we do that on the larger social scale? I think King's work points to that. I could say a lot more about King, but I want to stop here so we can have some chance to talk together. Thank you. Any reflections or questions, observations, please? Yeah, and I'll repeat them.
This is about hate, but not the kind of reactive hate that happen. Things yeah. that are, you know, it's, you know, our democracy could be destroyed. Things are under assault right now.
Yeah.
And when I see people deliberately causing delusion, distorting information,
yeah.
all creating alternate facts, that's the latest one, I get very, very concerned about
yeah.
the future, and I feel hate for what's happening.
Yeah.
The reactive part is that then I get angry at the people who are carrying that out, but in terms of having that feeling for the injustice of it
yeah.
and the danger.
Right, so thank you for really pointing to that concern, that issue. And again, the question is, if this was an interpersonal relationship, how would you respond following our practice? In other words, what's hard in our practice is, for many of us, certain kinds of distress where there's a high level of intensity. It can be something just in my own mind, just without anyone else being involved. It can be an interpersonal relationship. It can be a social relationship. So what we want to ask is, how can I respond to whatever's happening in ways that follow my practice? You know, and the fact that you're using the word hate is, I think, important, because, of course, that sounds like a direct contradiction to what we're aspiring towards with our practice, right? And so it's really a question of, is there a way to be with what you're experiencing that leads towards responsiveness and non-hatred? That's the aspiration. So how would we work with that? So probably a few things to talk about. First is just starting with, maybe with the wisdom that maybe something like what I just said, that this is happening now. I have an aspiration to be responsive rather than reactive, to have kindness and wise action rather than hatred, right? And that I could start there. And you know, that's really, a lot of our practice, we start with the wisdom aspect. And then I could know that there's something where what's happening with my reactions isn't quite there yet, right? And so then we would, with that perspective, we could then use our different tools. We could use mindfulness, we might do loving kindness, we might do compassion, and so forth. With mindfulness, we'd be particularly interested in just studying what's happening. You know, can study what are the emotions. Is there hatred? Is there, probably are other emotions. There's fear, right? There's anxiety. There's maybe anger, right? And so we work with those, we stay with them, we use mindfulness with them. And when we do that, typically there's some shift. You know, they don't stay there forever. You know, for example, something like anger often is a cover for other emotions, particularly love and care. And so if there's a way that if you actually stayed with that with mindfulness, you would actually probably get more to the depths of what really matters for you, which is that I'm really scared because democracy is really important and, you know, treating people respectfully and justice is really important. You'd probably get there, and you would probably, if you stayed with it, you probably would work through some of those feelings, move out of reactivity, but yet get really clear where you're coming from. And I think that inner process is actually key to response. You find something very similar with King. King said that the transformation of anger is at the heart of every social movement. You think of what King would do, right? Because King actually manifested love, or tried to, and empathy towards the people who were on the other side. You know, and there's some remarkable statements where he said, particularly the white working class people who are manifesting racism, he said they're really, you know, he had tremendous empathy for them. He said they're kind of lost, you know. He said that the movement is for black bodies and white souls. because he thought the souls were lost. And so, you know, this is this example. So we would try to go more deeply. And my sense is that if you stayed with mindfulness and stayed with loving kindness and worked with it, you would actually get a sense of what was beneath some of the difficult emotions. That would sort of ground you. Oh, you know, there are things I love. There are things I cherish. And then you could act coming more out of that. In other words, there's some inner purification practice that's necessary for anyone who's going to be involved. Because if we stay in a reactive place, it's actually not any different from what we're opposing in some fundamental way, right? You know, in some ways. Some ways it is, some ways it's not. And so if the inner process is real, that's why I'm suggesting that our practices are crucial for activists in this time. Because otherwise it just gets into opposition, and there's a way in which it's not that different. It's just reactivity. Right? That's a start, right? And then we also want to watch for, let's just say one more thing, that I've taught 3 retreats in the last 4.5 weeks. And the last 2 of them, I had requests for people. People wanted to talk about current events. In the last 2 retreats, I had optional gatherings on the last day, towards the end of the day, last half of supper. Optional meetings for people who wanted to connect their practice to current developments. And I tried to make it such that it would not get in the way of the momentum of the retreat, but still would offer resources and perspectives for people. And typically about 2/3 of the retreat came to both of these. I was told it was helpful and didn't overly agitate people or cause the retreat to lose its focus. But I found myself giving, just 3 bullet points to put on your refrigerator, so to speak. One of them is have ways of working with difficult emotions. Watch negative storylines that get constantly repeated. And then stay connected with community. Those were the 3 starting points that I gave.
Too fast.
What was the third one?
The third one is stay connected to community. Not watch out for being isolated. Those are the 3.
Yeah. What was the second one?
Okay. A little quick, Rose. First one was have ways of working with difficult emotions or distress. That's kind of what I just was mentioning. We've talked about that at times in the group here. And then secondly, particularly watch the negative storylines that one continually repeats to oneself. This is valuable in every part of one's life, but particularly here, one get really fixated on negative scenario, repeat it over and over again, and scare yourself into paralysis. And the third was stay connected to community. So these are not a comprehensive list, but that's a starting point. And that's what I wanted, people just, whatever else you remember those 3. They go a long way. Other thoughts, comments, reflections? Jim, please.
I find it very helpful to remember or to hold that everyone suffers. Everyone is suffering.
And, yeah.
They may be acting it out in different ways, as I do, but that everyone suffers and wishing, hoping they find peace and peace for them is helpful.
It's helpful, yeah. And again, to bring the heart practices is crucial. We can remember, when we think of metta practice or loving kindness practice, remember that we work up to the difficult person. So if you're working up to the difficult situation or bringing metta to people who maybe think differently than you, it's good to work up to it. But that's beautiful, to go to that kind of compassion. Clearly where someone like King could hang out there, right? He could hang out there and he could have compassion for those on the other side. And there are remarkable passages where he talks about the suffering of ordinary white working people taken into racism. Right? Remarkable passages. He really sincerely could feel, have that compassion and see the delusion, right? See the delusion that was there.
But maybe it's important to probably he didn't have that 24/7.
Yeah.
I loved Obama's, you know, saying that, yeah, he gets angry.
Yeah.
It may be off camera, but, you know, he's real.
Yeah, yeah, that it right. It's not, he's not fully awakened. Dalai Lama says he gets angry sometimes,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But he said the difference is, Dalai Lama says, you know, I come from a very irritable part of Tibet. Or how do you say it? He didn't even say it quite like that. He said, I come from a part of Tibet known for its irritable people. You know, it's not, you know, not in the usual model. And he said that, you know, what differentiates me from when I was 15 years old is not that I don't get irritable, it's that my recovery time is much quicker than it used to be. Maybe one more, and then we'll go to the meta cards. Yeah.
So there have been a couple of people who I've spoken with recently who are kind of who like me do some teaching, don't do residential retreats, but do some teaching in meditation groups in the Dharma tradition, who have surprised me because they have said that they feel that violence is justified in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that kind of seductive in some way, but I also simply, I don't see anything about that in the teachings at all. And I'm just curious to hear your take on that. For myself, I don't, at least at this point, I just...
Questions about violence, yeah.
Just seems like it's too easy to say that that could be the case.
Yeah. Well, it's a complex issue. I actually wrote a long article looking at all the history of that. It's both practical, but it has a scholarly kind of groundedness in that. And it's complex when you look at Buddhist tradition generally. It's not complex when you look at the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha, you know, non-harming was always what he advocated. It's very clear. In Buddhist tradition, there are exceptions to nonviolence that you find in Mahayana tradition. And there are texts where it's, you know, said that essentially in very extreme situations, violence can be appropriate. And you find your Mahayana texts that say that and say that one has to go through quite a purificatory process, and, you know, it only would be possible for an eighth stage bodhisattva who's purified tremendously. And the Dalai Lama was once asked to comment on that text, and he said, yeah, I know that text. I'm not there. Right, right. So there are some of those texts, and there also have been, you know, sort of spacious justifications of violence in some Buddhist traditions. You know, particularly Zen in the first half of the 20th century collaborated with Japanese militarism, you know, and, you know, some pretty bad stories. And I've heard apologies from Zen masters, Japanese Zen masters, about that. So... And, you know, and Gandhi's position is also somewhat complex. He thought that, he actually said at times, some of you who've studied Gandhi know, he said at times that he thought that violence was better than cowardice. Some very fairly striking statements. So they're both questions about violence from the point of view of principle and from the point of view of strategy and effectiveness, right? But I think that for someone like King, it was probably more of an absolute than it was for Gandhi. But it's close to an absolute for Gandhi. It seems to be an absolute for the Buddha. And it's close to an absolute in the Buddhist tradition. So maybe I'd be happy to post my article to the Marin website. Yeah, because it's... It was written a while ago. I wrote it like over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah. Yeah.
But this is just the last thing. I just wanted to say, to add to that, that there was a practitioner that went to Thailand or to India, and on her way she got robbed. And so she asked her very wise teacher what she should have done, or, you know, she didn't want to be violent or anything. He said, you should have hit that person as hard as you could when he was trying to steal from you with a lot of love.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard a similar story from Munindra. Maybe, I mean, it sounds very similar.
It might be. I might have just...
Sharon and Munindra.
Yeah, yeah, from the teacher of Joseph Goldstein, and Sharon, and other people who I met a few times, who did give that counsel. You should, I mean, again, there are degrees of what we call violence, and he said you should hit that person with your umbrella, but not to hurt the person, I think, but just to protect oneself. So there are a lot of complexities here, but I think so we have to maybe make a number of distinctions, but for someone like King, as far as I know, there were no exceptions, you know, in terms of social action. And the I think that's very appropriate now. But you know, it's a deep subject to study. You know, and you know, there were very interesting communications, for example, between Martin Buber and Gandhi in the late 1930s, in the context of the Nazis. So it gets complex, right? Very, you might look that up on the web. Very interesting discussions there. You know, Gandhi was still counseling nonviolence. And it's also, maybe I'll end with this, it's actually not well known that there were a number of very successful nonviolent responses to the Nazis. The most dramatic were the people of Denmark. Some of you know this history. It was really covered. There was a beautiful series called A Force More Powerful, which was the PBS program, six-segment program on nonviolence called A Force More Powerful, which is on YouTube. You can study it. And one of the segments was on Denmark. In 1940 or 41, the Danes were told to give up all their Jews to the Germans, the Danish government. There was some kind of a leak of that information a few days before the action was going to occur. And the Danish people en masse took all of their boats that they could find, and they saved virtually all the Jews by having them go on boats to Sweden, which was neutral. And they saved almost all of them, and the Nazis did not have any retribution. That's what's remarkable. Both that they didn't stop the action and that the action succeeded without retribution. And there are a number of other stories like that. Even in that very extreme situation, people always bring that up, what would nonviolence do against the Nazis? Well, in a number of situations, it actually succeeded.